Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On Building Bridges Radio, 107-year-old Tulsa Race Massacre survivor Viola Fletcher makes the case for remembering and for reparations. Then on the Belabored Podcast, Sarah Jaffe calls out officials and the media after tennis star Naomi Osaka's job action at the French Open. And with the dust barely settled after the Amazon organizing drive in Alabama, My Labor Radio brings us an update on the now 10-week-long strike between the United Mine Workers and Warrior Met Coal in Brookwood, Alabama. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has been catching a lot of flack lately for his stances on the filibuster, the PRO Act, and voting rights. Hollywood producer and longtime friend of The Rick Smith Show, Marshall Herskovitz, says Manchin might not be quite as wrong as most believe him to be. On the latest edition of the Teamsters podcast, we hear how the union is flexing its muscles in DC's corridors of power to make sure workers can join together and organize for better wages and safer workplaces. Then a Florida teacher and school board member dissect the state's inability to properly fund schools over the last year on the Educating from the Heart podcast. Operating Engineers Local 3 is the largest construction trades local in the country. And on the latest edition of Local 3's podcast, Breaking Ground, Public Employee Director Tim Neep and Senior Business Agent Mike Eggener pull back the curtain on some of their day-to-day work for their members. And our last report comes from On Writing, the podcast from the Writers Guild of America, East, as Zach Akers, writer and co-director of Shipworm, explains how his project is the first podcast to be covered on the Writers Guild Minimum Basic Agreement, and big shifts in the podcasting industry. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Remember, you can find all of today's shows, along with at least 100 more like them, at laborradionetwork.org. And if you enjoy the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, be sure to like and share. Solidarity does work. Here's the show.
With Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Now reparations and a reckoning for America to deal with its Tulsa race massacre.
I have never seen justice, said Tulsa race massacre survivor Viola Fletcher, a 107-year-old survivor of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, before a House committee on the need for the nation to make amends for the deadly attack on the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma, known as the Black Wall Street. A 35-block radius in the segregated community that was thriving with hundreds of businesses, where on May 31st through June 1st, 1921, the entire area was burned down by a white mob and killing hundreds of black residents and injuring 800 others. Let's listen to Viola Fletcher.
My name is Viola Ford Fletcher. I'm the daughter of Lucinda Ellis and John Wesley Ford of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm the sister of Hughes Van Ellis, who is also here today. I'm a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 107th birthday. Today, I'm visiting Washington, D.C. for the first time in my life. I'm here seeking justice, and I'm asking my country to acknowledge what happened in Tulsa in 1921. On May 31st in 21, I went to bed in my family's home in Greenwood, neighbors of Tulsa, the neighborhood I felt asleep in that night, was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me. Greenwood should have given me the chance to truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seen being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not, and our descendants do not. When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the fourth grade. I have never made much money in my country. State and city took a lot from me. Despite this, I spent time supporting the war effort in the shipyards of California. But most of my life, I was a domestic worker serving white families. I never made much money. To this day, I can barely afford my everyday needs. I am 107 years old and have never been seen justice. I pray that one day I will.
Mother Fletcher, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So thank you for putting us on the right course to learn and to understand, and to do better.
America, when will justice be served, asked Viola Fletcher, 107-year-old survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.
You're listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored Podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hi, Michelle. The big sports news this week is that tennis star Naomi Osaka pulled out of the French Open after being fined for skipping a press conference. Naturally, because Osaka is a young and occasionally outspoken woman of color, she took part in last summer's strike wave of black athletes after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, saying, quote, "Before I am an athlete, I am a black woman. If I can get a conversation started in a majority white sport, I consider that a step in the right direction." So, of course, the press lost their damn minds about it. But others have noted that, once again, Osaka's withdrawal is a job action. She is withdrawing her labor as one of the best and therefore most billable athletes on the court from conditions she finds intolerable. And she's not the first to challenge the strange obsession with the post-game press conference. Several friends and readers of mine, including good friend of the show Kenzo Shibata, noted that in Work Won't Love You Back, I wrote about NFL running back Marshawn Lynch's protest of the press conference a few years ago, when he turned up and simply answered every question with, "I'm just here so I don't get fined." Yes, listeners, I bought the t-shirt that he subsequently sold with the slogan on it. As friend of the show Mariam Kaba noted on Twitter, this strange idea that pro athletes owe us attendance at a press conference because they have accumulated some social capital skips over the people who have much more power and yet no obligation to regularly speak to the press. She noted, quote, "Are y'all clamoring for Warren Buffett to be fined by his company for not talking to the press when he doesn't feel like it?" As a journalist who covers, you know, actual capital, bosses, and politicians, I have to report that I have often heard no, or more often simply gotten radio silence when I make an interview request for of the more powerful, much more often than I have gotten access. And even the time-honored press conference is usually a stylized performance where slick operators like New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo ask reporters for presumed softball questions. The powerful get to pick and choose who's even in the room. The idea that even when done in the White House, the press conference somehow produces important information is often laughable, and I say this as a professional political journalist. When it comes to athletes, and particularly women athletes and Black athletes, and Osaka is both, the press conference is little more than an attempt to stoke some drama. As Jonathan Liu wrote in The Guardian, the press conference is, quote, really a lowest common denominator transaction, a cynical and often predatory game in which the object is to mine as much content from the subject as possible. Gossip, good. Anger, good. Feuds, good. Tears, good. Personal tragedy, good. Meanwhile, the young athlete, often still caught up in the emotions of victory or defeat, is expected to answer the most intimate questions in a least intimate setting, in front of an array of strangers and backed by a piece of sponsored cardboard. End quote. In women's tennis, where the subjects are so often young and pretty, and heaven help them, of course, if the reporters don't find them pretty, Liu notes, the press conference, quote, takes place not just in a largely white male space, but a white male with free food space. That sense of voracious, engorged entitlement often manifests itself in exceptionally creepy ways. Question, I noticed you tweeted a picture. Are you prepared that if you go on a long run, you may be held up as a sex symbol, given you're very good looking? Jeannie Bouchard, Wimbledon 2013. Question, you're a pinup now, especially in England. Is that good? Do you enjoy that? A 17-year-old Maria Sharapova, Wimbledon 2004, end quote. Osaka, citing her mental health in a year where no doubt she's faced racist backlash and who knows what personal stresses on top of the game and all of the other stresses that all of us have been through in this year of pandemic hell, refused to participate in the emotional labor of letting a bunch of reporters ask her personal questions, was punished, and withdrew her labor entirely. And then the real capper on this story is that the president of the French Tennis Federation gave a statement to reporters on Osaka's withdrawal and then left, refusing to take questions. Presumably, he'll be fined next.
You've been listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. For the entire archive of past episodes, visit dissentmagazine.org. Join us online using hashtag Belabored.
And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio.
How you doing, everybody? This is Mark, your host on My Labor Radio. Thanks for joining us. There's another really important labor dispute going on in America. There's multiple ones, but this one I'm going to specifically talk about is United Mine Workers versus Warrior Met. Now, what is Warrior Met? Warrior is the company's name, and Met is short for metallurgical coal. Now, not all coal is the same kind of coal, but imagine that your job as a miner is to arrive at the parking lot of your job site and then travel 2,000 feet below the Earth's surface just to complete your day's work. It'll take you an hour to get to the work site once you're in the parking lot at one of the mines. So they've struck in four places, mine 4, 5, and 7, and the central shop that runs everything. So they have scabs being bussed in now. If you're listening to this in early June 2021, they have been on strike for 10 weeks. They went out April 1st, 2021, when they went on strike. For a quick historical overview, in 2016, the previous company, Welch Energy, went into bankruptcy. The people who are running it today received bonuses before they went into bankruptcy. They had this by design set up to go into bankruptcy so that years later they could force change. Well, they did force change at that time. Those people, those miners, took a $6 pay cut back then because they knew it was important to keep the work in the family, in the area, in Alabama. Guess what happened? This many years later, here we are in a strike because they don't want to come to the table and bargain. They said, go on strike, we'll replace you. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're busing in scabs. People are being arrested on a daily basis down there, and it's only going to get bigger. You might not have heard of this story, but you're going to hear about it soon enough. One of the key things that Warrior Met wants to do, when you look at their prospectus that they put out in the first quarter of 2021, trying to entice investors, is Blue Creek development. What they want to do is, out of these coal mines 2,000 feet below the Earth's surface, get the coal 300 miles from Brookwood, Alabama, to Mobile and load it on ships so they can ship it over to China and elsewhere, because this coal, metallurgical coal, is used in the manufacturing of steel. So then they can sell it back over here to us. Whose team are they on? Anyway, we got to take the time to hats off to these miners and their families. They're having a struggle, and they could really use your support. UMWA.org is United Mine Workers of America. Once you're at the .org, you'll easily see a link to an area where you can make a donation. There is a food pantry that you could donate money to, and they would really appreciate that. There are 1,100 miners who are on strike at these three mines and the central shop. Understand, when you talk about that, that's upwards of 4,000 to 5,000 family members that are affected by someone, mother or father, who's not going to work and is on strike against Warrior Met in Alabama. Support the United Mine Workers. Go to umwa.org to find out more.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a lot of talk about Joe Manchin and West Virginia. And what's interesting to me is the good folks at End Citizens United did a little opinion poll of the folks in West Virginia and found that some of the Biden policies pretty popular, like the American Rescue Plan, the COVID relief plan. 64% of the folks there in West Virginia favored it, 31% not. The American Jobs Plan that Joe Biden has proposed, 68% of West Virginians said, yeah, we like that. And of the For the People Act, a whopping 79% said that they believe that everyone should have the right to vote and we should make it easier and do the things that are in that. I got to tell you, I'm fairly shocked by that number. Which tells me maybe people are getting a different message than Joe Manchin and the rest of the Republican Party. I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, you know, what do Democrats do with Joe Biden? What do they do with the filibuster? Is Joe Biden, is Joe Manchin right? We can't get rid of the filibuster because it would be bad? Well, here to share some thoughts, I've asked our good friend Marshall Hertzkowitz to come talk with us. Marshall's an American film director, writer, producer, currently the president emeritus of the Producers Guild of America. Marshall, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
So you've got this opinion poll out saying, you know what, people pretty happy with Joe Biden, pretty happy with some of the policy directions and the For the People Act, 79%. Yep. I got to tell you, yep. I'm shocked by that number.
Yep. Yes. But of course, people don't know what's in it. So, you know, they like the idea of, you know, people being allowed to vote. And I think that's very important that that's popular. But I think, honestly, I think we're looking at this whole thing through the wrong lens. I mean, you know, people are talking about Manchin and whether he should support this or that, whether he should be, getting rid of the filibuster. I mean, you and I were just talking about this. I think the only lens we should be looking through right now is 2022 and 2024. We are in such danger. I mean, we would be in danger even if, 14, 15, 16 states weren't really considering ending democracy by allowing their legislatures to overturn elections.
Right.
I mean, when you look at the Texas bill, it's not even as bad as a lot of these other bills, because they can invalidate an election, but that just means they have to hold another one. Some of these ones are literally going to let the legislatures decide. It's a nightmare. So the point is, we have to only be thinking of how do we have landslide victories in 22 and 24 when history tells us we're going to lose. So, we are up against such an enormous difficulty right now. So the focus has to be, how do you win? Now, it may be that the way to win is to get rid of the filibuster and pass all this stuff that we want to do and get it done quickly. It may be that's not the way to win. So, you know, for instance, let's talk about For the People Act. The For the People Act has a lot of problems, and the Democrats should admit it has a lot of problems. It is a Democratic wish list. It is a partisan act. And I'm not saying, by the way, that I believe the Republicans would support it. That's not my point. They're never going to support it. The Republicans aren't going to support anything we do. The battle is for the hearts and minds of the people. And what I'm saying is there are things in the For the People Act that the right can use against Democrats that don't need to be in there. You don't need automatic registration. You don't need same-day registration. That we haven't had that before, and we don't need that to win elections. That's a wish list, okay? What we need is to get rid of gerrymandering. What we need is to get rid of suppression. You know, there are so many aspects of what we do need, and we should be getting rid of the things we don't need, because what we're doing is we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, but isn't that from a negotiating standpoint? If you're taking your legislation, your wish list, for instance, into negotiation, yes, with someone who's going to give you nothing, these give you things to then take off the table.
That's my whole point, and you're exactly right. There's no one to negotiate with anymore.
So what you're doing is you're negotiating with yourself. I'm of the mindset, yes, if you're going to not negotiate with me and you're going to give me my wish list, I'm going to take my wish list.
No, all right, here's where I disagree, okay? Who we're negotiating with is the American people. Who we're negotiating with is the 75 million people who voted for Donald Trump, you know, who and more of them who voted for Republican candidates instead of Democratic candidates, that we have to negotiate against ourselves. And I'll tell you why, because it's about acting in good faith. What the American people really want right now is someone who's going to act in good faith. And if the Democrats say, this is the bill we actually need as Americans, it's not a progressive bill, it's an American bill, there are tens of millions of people who are going to hear that in the United States. And those are the people we need to change their vote from the Republican in their state to the Democrat in their state. So that's why I say, yes, we should be negotiating against ourselves, not out of weakness, because that's how you win elections. Thank you, as always.
Good stuff. Our good friend Marshall Herskowitz.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Teamsters podcast. I'm Kara Dennis of the Teamsters Communications Department. In this episode, we'll learn why the union is pushing lawmakers to support pro-worker legislation like the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan that would bring respect and dignity to the job while giving workers better work-life balance. To start, I turn to my colleague Ted Gotch to tell us more about the Teamsters' efforts to get Capitol Hill to act on measures that will build America back stronger and ensure that those risking their lives and safety are justly compensated for it. Ted?
Thanks, Kara. I recently spoke to Sunshine McBride, Deputy Director of the Teamsters Department of Political and Legislative Action, about why legislative efforts are important. Sunshine, thanks for joining us.
Sure, I'm happy to be here.
So to get started, while much of the Teamsters' legislative focus in the early days of the Biden administration rightfully centered around multi-employer pension reform, the White House has since unveiled two bold legislative packages, the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan, that contain a lot of proposals the union likes. Can you talk about them in detail?
Sure. So it's hard, I think, to overstate what we've learned through the pandemic about where our nation is falling short in its treatment of working people and working families. The post-pandemic recovery, I think we all hope, presents an opportunity to address massive structural inequities and rebuild the economic foundations of our country to create a more equitable and a more inclusive economy. And these two plans out of the White House, the American Jobs Act and the American Recovery Act, I think clearly get that, get the moment that we're in and the opportunity that's in front of us. The American Recovery Act, the stimulus bill, was the Biden plan to stop the virus and really address the needs of Americans most in crisis at the height of the pandemic. The American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan combined are the Biden administration's proposal for building back now that we are turning a corner on the crisis and getting it under control. It feels like we're getting it under control. The American Jobs Plan is a huge public investment in our nation's crumbling infrastructure. The American Families Plan then also calls for mandated paid family leave and affordable child and health care, while also alleviating tax burdens for working families. And as a critical companion to both proposals, you know, specifically from labor's perspective, the president directly calls for passage of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act.
So are there other legislative or regulatory priorities that Teamsters are stressing that don't fall under these two broad proposals?
I'd say everything we're fighting for in this Congress is about creating good, safe union jobs. So in theory, everything we're pushing is related to these proposals in some way, even if not specifically a part of these proposals. Passing the PRO Act is absolutely at the top of our priority list for this Congress. NLRA reform and leveling the playing field for workers who are trying to form a union is, you know, obviously absolutely crucial. Addressing the misclassification of workers and strengthening joint employer protections, making sure that the Teamsters union is shaping policy that dictates safe and appropriate use of automated vehicles, and then certainly working through policymakers to hold companies like Amazon accountable to their employees and accountable for their impact on the overall economy. We have a long to-do list for this Congress. And the truth is we've already had a lot of success in our policy priorities, not even 100 days into the administration and Congress. The multi-employer pension solution, of course, was huge. But we've also got our first card-carrying union member as Secretary of Labor. Under Secretary Walsh's leadership, the DOL rolled back a Trump-era rule that made it easier to misclassify employees as independent contractors, and they're set to roll back another bad Trump-era rule that weakened joint employer protection. The president also told workers organizing at Amazon that he supported their right to form a union and to do so without employer intimidation tactics. The president has also formed a task force that will issue recommendations on how the government can use existing authority to help workers join labor unions and bargain collectively. So we have a lot to do, but we're feeling really optimistic that a lot can be accomplished over the next 4 years.
Okay. So what is the union doing to encourage elected officials to act on these Teamster priorities?
So our union's political power and legislative success is very much rooted in Teamster members taking action. So our efforts to encourage elected officials to act on our priorities builds off the work that our joint councils and local unions are doing in state. A coordinated lobbying and field effort is what delivered on the top priority of our Build Back Stronger campaign, Secure Pensions, that very much coordinated effort between the field and DC. And now our sights are set on the other core pillars of our Teamsters Build Back Stronger plan, strong unions and good jobs. And it will again take a coordinated effort between lobbying and significant action from the field, from the membership, to make sure that we're really able to utilize this moment in which we have pro-worker majority in the House, Senate, and the White House.
Great. Sunshine, thank you very much for your time and for your explanation of the legislative agenda of the Teamsters going forward.
Sure. Of course, Ted.
The Teamsters are committed to flexing its political muscle to bring change to the nation's corridors of power.
Listening to Educating from the Heart. Here are your hosts, Tina Dunbar and Luke Flint.
All right, welcome back, everyone. And Luke, it is so good to finally see you.
Yes, not just on a computer screen, but we're actually in the same room together.
Yes, recording for the first time our podcast together. This is a wonderful experience.
Yes. Know?
And unfortunately, it took till the end of the school year to get to it. Yes, this seems like it's been the longest school year ever. You noticed that?
Oh, God. You know, during the pandemic, we heard a lot of talk about how educators are valued. And I'm wondering, did we actually see any of that in the budget?
Well, I think we saw the exact opposite this year, and it's kind of confusing the way it happened. Now, remember last year's new teacher pay mandate to increase starting salaries to $47,500? It was supposed to elevate salaries for first-year teachers, making Florida one of the top states in the nation on starting salaries. At least that was the governor's rhetoric. The legislature allocated $500 million to the budget. Now, more than a year later, we see that pot of money wasn't enough. It focused exclusively on first-year teachers, as I mentioned, but that divisive mandate left out others, especially experienced teachers. They were left out in the cold as far as pay goes.
You know, that sounds really complicated. I mean, luckily, we do have a couple of experts here with us to talk about the state's education budget.
That's right, Luke. So with us today are Kathy Bain. She's a former teacher from Escambia County and a legislative specialist for the Florida Education Association. We also have Paul Fesco. He's a school board member in Escambia County and a former assistant superintendent. We start by asking both of them about the level of education funding. Kathy, how do you assess this year's budget as compared to past year's budgets?
I'm of two minds. I think that we are lucky we don't have massive cuts. I think we're fortunate that the federal government is providing a whole lot of money to kind of fill in the shortfall that we have for tax revenue. It is not a budget that's going to allow us to make great strides in teacher salaries, but I do think that we'll be able to maintain the services that we've offered. I'm worried about making progress. I think, you know, the teacher salary and staff shortages, I think, will persist, and I don't think we make progress on that.
Okay. Paul? I concur with Kathy on her statements that is where we are. I think that, unfortunately, things may need to get worse before they get better, okay? In order for some people to get off with some of the initiatives that they think are a priority, the reality is going to be this. They better be putting some work into what they're going to do to fill the teacher shortage, because something's going to give. Okay, it's got to. If we don't have people out there who want to teach and who are good teachers, we can't continue to do things that we're doing. Class sizes will double, maybe triple. Who knows? And you know, somebody's going to have to thumb their nose to the class size reduction thing and say, I don't have a warm body to go in there. I could put these kids in that classroom, but they won't have a teacher. Okay. I think that what needs to happen is some of the priorities that are happening with the current budget in terms of salaries are going to need to be redirected and looked at in a more reasonable way.
All right, that's it for our show, and we have a brief programming note as we wrap up the first season of Educating from the Heart. We're going to take a brief pause over the summer, but we'll be back with brand new episodes to kick off the new school year.
While we're away, you can always listen to prior episodes of our podcast by visiting feaweb.org/podcast. Again, that's feaweb.org/podcast.
Also, if you enjoy Educating from the Heart, please give us a rating and review and ask your friends and colleagues to subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again real soon. Until then, keep educating from the heart.
Hello, viewers and listeners of Local 3's podcast, Breaking Ground. Today, I'm pleased to have with us the Director of the Public Employees Unit, Tim Neap, and the Senior Business Agent, Mike Eggener. We're going to talk a little bit today about how the Local 3 Public Employee Division fits into the overall Local 3 fold. And I want to hear from both of you directly about what you do for your thousands of members every day on the public employee side. But first, a little bit of background. Many of us already know that Local 3 began representing construction workers in 1939 in California and Nevada. and this representation would later spread to public employees in 1969. Now, the public employee division has been a mainstay for Local 3's jurisdiction because presently today we represent about 7,000 members in about 200 specific units across Northern California, Nevada, and Utah.
My name is Tim Neap, and I started in construction about 1985. And I was actually in the private sector as a mechanic. I had very much interest in getting into the union. So I was just started in this organization on the representation side, and I was dealing with a Unit 12 person, a state employee, Caltrans. And a gentleman said to me he didn't get paid, and I thought, well, that's easily fixed. I'll go talk to your supervisor. And the supervisor said, okay, I'll make sure that that person gets paid. And unbeknown to me, a couple weeks passed, I got a phone call and said, I hadn't got paid. And found out that's what actually introduced me to how much the same the work is, but the internal process to get things fixed was quite different.
My name is Michael Agner. I've been on staff for 11 years. Basically, Tim's assistant is the senior rep, so I have an office in Alameda as well. So I help him with all of the things that he's got going on because it's hard keeping track on everybody.
Looking back at it all, I'm still here.
It's a long career too. I've seen a lot of change.
Yes.
I've been part of, you know, a lot of city, county elections, different political movements in each city to have understood the value of negotiating for these specific, very complicated units.
Right.
That requires a lot of, it's a skill.
Local 3 has always been an organization that would hit the root of the problem. They will make sure that the grievances, arbitrations, litigation is very solid, and through that process, we do have a lot of respect with the employers, with the politicians. They do understand that about Local 3, that we won't go out there and waste their time. A lot of the membership, you know, they want to look at you as a business agent, and you don't really know what you're talking about, but been there, done that. So it does make me very credible at the bargaining table. When I'm across the table, my members recognize that. This guy understands what we do and be able to represent them fully through that process.
One of our biggest, I guess, nemesis right now are law firms. They try to steal our members and they say, hey, you know, you'll have our lawyer, and it doesn't work that way. And so with OE3, we have our own legal department. We have, you know, our political department. We have you, our PR department. You came out recently to Groveland for us and helped us with a story there. So, I mean, these are all resources and lobbyists.
Thank you for joining me today and just explaining. And if there are any questions, you can always go, like I said, to our website, oe3.org, on how to reach out to a public employee division or a district to find out more information on how to get organized into Local 3.
Thank you. And thank you, Mandy, for your support.
You know, we can get 500 likes on this. Tim and Mike will be back.
Yeah, on the YouTube video, please like and subscribe.
Yeah. You're listening to On Writing, a podcast from the Writers Guild of America East. I'm your host, Jerry Cole. In each episode, you'll hear writers working in film, television, and news break down everything from the writing process to pitching, favorite jokes to key scenes, and so much more. Today, I'm speaking with Zach Akers, writer of the first-of-its-kind feature-length scripted podcast Shipworm, now available on all streaming services. Shipworm is a two-hour narrative story that stars Broadway luminary Quentin Earl Darrington as Wallace Conway, a small-town doctor who wakes up to find he's been implanted with an untraceable chip that allows a mysterious voice to lead him on a deadly journey that threatens his family, friends, and his own life. Zach, along with his creative partner Skip Bronchi, run the podcast production company 2UP, the studio known for groundbreaking fiction, musical, and documentary podcasts like 36 Questions, The Wilderness, and Limetown, which has recently been adapted into a TV series for Facebook Watch. I spoke with Zach about how Shipworm is the first podcast to be covered under the Writers Guild Minimum Basic Agreement, the challenges and freedoms of writing for audio, and about how doctors working during the pandemic, a rented duck, and a rare and elusive type of mollusk all played a role in creating his latest project. So hi, Zach. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you for having me. This is great.
I want to talk, specifically a little bit about Shipworm.
It was the first podcast covered under the WBA's minimum basin agreement, which is the contract that covers film and television writers. Do you have any advice to podcast creators and or production companies about why they should consider covering and like making their production company signatory? Like, what was the decision, I guess, to make this podcast guild covered?
I think there's lots of reasons, but I think the biggest reason is it legitimizes the medium to be sort of like an industry that the guild protects, because the Writers Guild is so important. It does so many different things. But I think that to me makes it a legitimate place for writers to do work and to feel safe in doing that work. And I feel like that needs to keep pushing forward, because I mean, it's just, you know, I've been in the guild for a few years now, and I've been lucky to be in the guild for the last few years. And it's just, it's really, among other things, just calming to have a community, but also sort of like you feel like you're being taken care of. You know that you won't be taken advantage of, that there's all these tools to sort of like help you out if you feel lost. And it's a network of human beings who are all sort of broken the same way you are, you know, that all have the same like brain. I don't know what it is, you know, as writers, but it's just, to us, we didn't even know it was an option, you know, until the guild reached out to us and they were like, hey, we want to start doing this and we want to start offering this for podcasts. And it was just sort of a no-brainer thing for us. Like, if we can do this, we should. And we just so happen to be the first ones, but I know that there are more coming and that there are more that are going to be produced. And that's just, it's a great thing. I think it's sort of a game changing moment for podcasting. And I think that it's just, it's really important to keep pushing it as much as possible.
In the Guild podcast series, The On Writing Guide to Crafting Scripted Podcasts, which you kindly participated in, you talked about the creative and business side of creating podcasts. Since those episodes were about 2 years ago, and the podcasting landscape has changed a good bit, I'm curious to your thoughts on the industry shift and how it's impacted your work and mindset.
Well, I think it's changed for good and for bad. I think the bad part of the industry is that it has certainly become more corporate, and it has certainly become more like television, and that there are studios and that there are very certain paths to get things done, as opposed to sort of in the days of Limetown when we first started, it was just sort of like, yeah, we just put it out there and people, you know, and it was, it could do just as well as anything else. Where I feel like now, because there is a massive podcast market. I think I read something like there's more than a million podcasts now, and you're sort of like forced into avenues of following a studio system, which again is good and bad. Like, it's good that the industry is being legitimized in such a way, but it's bad for independent producers or people who are just starting out. But I do think the exciting thing and sort of the unknown thing is the new subscription model that's being introduced by Apple and Spotify, and I'm sure everyone else, that will allow for direct payment to the creator. So it means that you no longer have to rely on advertising for money, which is like also a busted system for fictional podcasts, and it's hard to make money that way. But if you have 10,000 loyal listeners to whatever you're doing and you charge a certain amount, you can make a good amount of money that way, and you can be an independent producer that way. So I think that that might change this industry in a way that people don't fully understand yet. And when I say people, I mean myself too. It could either fall flat, or it could be something that is truly game changing and allows more people into the space and allows more people to make a living doing it this way. So I am excited about that and to see if that makes the changes that we think that it will.
Well, I'm excited to learn what they are.
Yeah, thank you.
Awesome. That's it for this episode. On Writing is a production of the Writers Guild of America East. Tech production and original music is by Stockboy Creative. You can learn more about the Writers Guild of America East online at wgaeast.org, and you can follow the Guild on social media at wgaeast. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and rate us. I'm Jerry Cole. Thank you for listening, and write on.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly,
our roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon, Chris Garlock, and myself. Chris Garlock produced the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. We really hope you enjoyed this show, and we hope it inspires you to explore the other shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 100 across the country and around the world, ordinary folks who are working hard to air the voices of workers. If you do like what you hear, please spread the word about this amazing and growing world of labor radio and podcast shows. Like the show and share it on social media. Sonic solidarity, if you will. Thanks in advance. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Bangert Drowned, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local labor radio podcast show.